This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast. I'm your podcast host, Dr. Raj Balkar, and more importantly, I have the pleasure, the honor of welcoming back to the podcast Dr. Patrick Olivelle, who is Professor Emeritus in the Department of South Asian Studies at the University of Texas. We are going to discuss a really, really fascinating work, Ashoka, Portrait of a Philosopher King. Patrick, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you.
Well, it's a great work on a great figure. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the genesis and backstory and maybe fold in the idea of biography as genre, biography as an enterprise in sort of the academic sphere? Could you tell us a bit about that?
Yes. Well, this was rather accidental, as many things in my life have been. I didn't set out deciding to write to this book. I had been in correspondence with Professor Ramchandra Guha, and he wrote to me once about 3 years ago, saying that he's starting a new series called Indian Lives, which are biographies of 40 major Indian figures from the past and modern world. And he asked me whether I would do the book on Ashoka. That the first time I ever thought of writing a biography of Ashoka. I had worked on Ashoka for the past 15, 20 years, but, you know, it wasn't the center or focus of my work. I gave it some thought and I had some ideas about what was wrong with the biographies we already have of Ashoka. And then finally, with a bit of trepidation, I said yes, especially because Ram always had a very clear idea of what a biography does. What a biography does is introduce history of a particular period by focusing on a figure and through the figure as a lens looking at what's happening during that period. And I thought that was a very interesting way of looking at biography and at history. And he also thought that biography was ordinary man's way of entering into history rather than purely historical books. So that was my beginning of this. It took me 2 to 3 years to finally complete it. And the way I distinguished my book from others was to look at Ashoka's own words and not look at all the noise that surrounds him in other kinds of work, especially the Buddhist hagiographies. So my book comes straight from Ashoka's own words, which has its own limitations and problems, but also it has its good sides in the sense that this is what Ashoka does and not what others several centuries after Ashoka did or said about him.
You perfectly preempt actually the next question that I had intended to ask, which is, about his words. You know, what do we have available? What is the evidence? Where do we find his words? Whereby does one piece together his biography?
Yeah. So if you look at Ashoka, you have two or three different kinds of sources for Ashoka. First of all, you have Ashoka's own words, which are a little over 4,000 words. So it's not a large corpus, but it is large enough for a person who is writing in the 3rd century before Christ, right? So his own words and his own artifacts. He was as Professor Asher has said, he was the first patron of art in India because all these magnificent pillars and capitals, the lion capital of Ashoka is now the emblem of India. It was his, he sponsored that. He was the patron of that. So those are the two things that we have, both artistic, archaeological, and linguistic. When you get beyond that, you have all the Buddhist writings about Ashoka. You have Ashoka Avadana, for example, which is a Sanskrit word that dealing with Buddha, with the Ashoka and his life. We have Sri Lankan tradition of the chronicles that deals with Ashoka bringing Buddhism to Sri Lanka. We have even Ashvaghosha, the famous Sanskrit Kavya writer, who concludes his Buddha Charita, the Buddha's life, with the life of Ashoka. So Ashoka was the sort of the final crowning of Buddhism. So we have those kinds of, we have a little bit from the Brahmanical side, but just names. In the Puranas, they give the list of names and Ashoka kings, and Ashoka's name comes there. So those are the things that we have. The Buddhist ones are 3 to 4 centuries after Ashoka. So they are basically hagiographies or memories, not contemporary records.
How can we, or should we even, how does one disambiguate the man from the myth, from the legend? How do we treat the narrative versus history, or is there a relationship there? Say more about that process.
Yes. So what I tried to do was simple. I tried not to deal with anything that is not found in Ashoka's own words. The only exception to that were other contemporary records. And those are especially from the Greek sources, because you must realize that this is the time when Alexander the Great came to India. And that was during the time of Ashoka's grandfather. After Alexander died, his empire was divided into several kingdoms. And the one that is closest to India was Seleucus Nicator, who presided over that and who came to treaty with Ashoka's grandfather, Chandragupta. So we have that kind of contemporary evidence from outside of India. Within India, we have zero outside of Ashoka's own words. So what I tried to do was basically not deal with anything else. Some people have asked me to do not to discount everything that is stated in Buddhist, because there could be some historically valid information. And I fully agree with that, except nobody has given me the key to unlocking this historical information from the hagiographical, except some my own bias saying, oh, that can't be right, that can't be true. But I don't have a method by which I can take the historical and leave behind the hagiographical.
Right. That's an important bit, this ambiguation. So you're relying upon strictly that which you can consider historical evidence,
right,
in order to construct a narrative, ironically used here, a narrative of his life. Now, certainly he's a looming figure. He's a significant figure. Has this been attempted before? To what extent is this a novel enterprise?
You mean to say a biography of Ashoka?
Correct.
Biography of Ashoka has been written over and over again. The very first one was by Vincent Smith, who was the British Indologist. And he wrote The Life of Ashoka. His one was almost completely based on the Buddhist sources. And if you look through the now 100, 150 years of writings on Ashoka, most of the biographies, not most, I'd say all of the biographies, are in one way or the other based on Buddhist narrative. I find that even some very good and very meticulous scholars often fall back into the Buddhist narrative, saying, for example, when Ashoka was the regent in Taxila, or when he was the regent in Vidisha. We don't know that. We know that only from the Buddhist literature.
Yeah. Well, it seems that, you know, with respect to examining the life of this figure, this perhaps isn't a novel work, but methodologically it is. It's rather unprecedented as far as I know. You would know the literature far better than I would. For someone to take a look at strictly the historically verifiable aspects and piece that together, would you say?
That is certainly right. This is what Professor Stephanie Jameson says. Oliver's novel approach to write a biography of Ashoka in Ashoka's own words, that is, words of his inscriptions, provides us with an entirely fresh and surprising portrait of the great Mauryan emperor, stripped of millennia of hagiography and religious piety and resituated in a conceptual landscape of Ashoka's civil religion. So basically, this had not been done before. Why? I have no idea, right? Because it's not a big discovery to go and read his own words. But one problem, of course, is this, that one has to do a very deep dive and a very close reading in order to get the persona of that man emerge from his words. So that's not an easy task in the sense of there are no low-hanging fruits that you can just pluck and say, this is Ashoka. So you really have to go down deep.
So I laughed. Thankfully, I mute myself when my guests are speaking, but I was laughing out loud because you say, you know, this seems rather straightforward. I have no idea why no one's attempted this, and yet it's novel. And I was thinking to myself, my doctoral work in my first book was doing a narrative, a literary analysis of the Devi Mahatmya as a synchronic text. And I was thinking to myself, ridiculously, that was not a novel enterprise. No one in 200 years of colonial scholarship decided to take seriously the fabric of the text and analyze it as a whole in that sense. And so it is interesting that this hasn't been done before, but now that you've done it, one wonders why. And let's talk about that in the sense of, one imagines that you've leveraged much of your career thus far and your skills and your knowledge in order to do some of the gleaning, fleshing out, interpretation. So what else are you relying on to bring out the persona, as you say, in addition to these words? Or what's helping you to make the most out of his words and interpret them, would you say?
Yeah. As I was reading it, I tried to make my book somewhat user-friendly rather than a deep philological analysis of Ashoka's inscriptions that would really bore an ordinary person to death. I tried to read all the philology that has been done on Ashoka's inscriptions, but not to write the philology in the book, but make the book have the inspiration for the book come from the philology, but present the book to the people in easy to read language. You know? So that was, I think, my main objective. And one main part of that is to divide this person into four aspects. First of all, he was a ruler. You can talk about philosophy, you can talk about Buddhism, you can talk, but ultimately he had to run a country. So my first part is about Ashoka as the ruler. And then clearly at some point, his Buddhist faith, his, we could call it some kind of a conversion to Buddhism, defined his early years of his public life, as he writes, and this is especially true in the first minor rock inscription. And then he has two other specifically Buddhist inscriptions, the Schism Edict and the Bhairat Edict to the Buddhist Sangha. So I did the second part on Ashoka the Buddhist, but his major part of his life and the thrust of his inscriptions was Ashoka's Dharma. Dharma, the term Dharma occurs more than 100 times in his inscriptions. And that was the bedrock, the anchor of his moral philosophy. So Ashoka becomes a moral philosopher. So that's the third part, is Ashoka as a moral philosopher. And the fourth part, which I think is one of the most interesting, is that Ashoka was also an ecumenist, meaning he wanted not only to treat all religions alike, but also for religions to cooperate with each other, that they should not consider each other in an antagonistic way, but as a fellow people of faith who can talk to each other, and as this is very important, learn from each other. So this is something that he inculcates in many of his inscriptions on what he calls the Pashandas. Pashanda is what we would call today a religion.
You know, the entire book I find utterly fascinating, and it's lucid insofar as there are these, you know, there are these aspects of self or roles or hats worn by the head of Ashoka. But I have to agree that the fourth and final part is perhaps the most thought-provoking with respect to, you know, is it apples and oranges comparing the sort of ideology to a person of his time and station? Or is he really capable of the sort of holding of space for multiple paradigms the way that, you know, along the lines of what we might ascribe to a modern quote-unquote secular state? And say a little bit more about that, because I think that's really fascinating. And obviously, you know the literature far better than I ever will, given your area of study. But I don't know that I've quite even considered that before.
Right. That is an aspect of Ashoka's writings that has not been highlighted sufficiently, I think. Although people are beginning to do that, not so much people who are doing philology on Sanskrit, but people who are in political science and looking at modern India, secularism, what does secularism mean in India? That, like Professor Rajiv Bhargava and people like that, right, has been doing that. So what Ashoka was probably, as I say in the epilogue, was probably many centuries, if not millennia, before his time. So in a sense, he was preaching a doctrine that looks so enticing and appealing to us living in the 20th and 21st centuries, right? But he was doing that 2,000 years ago. So this is the very interesting aspect of Ashoka, that he was speaking in what could be viewed today from our perspective as a modern voice. And I use the term ecumenism. That's the 20th century word. It had no meaning before that, right? So I'm using a modern word to characterize what Ashoka was. So yes, but as I say in the epilogue, it was ultimately, at least in the narrow sense of the word, a failure. Because his program that he so eloquently talks about didn't outlast his death. We do not know what his children did, but clearly within 50 years, it was dead latter. Right? So this is, and it has been revived now thanks to British colonial administrators who deciphered his, for 2,000 years, his words were not understood, could not be. So this is such a strange, thing that happened in history, that princeps finally deciphered the words, and we are able now to read these, what I call the talking stones, right? The talking stones, and we are able to read that. And Ashoka's remain ultimately a dead letter all this time. Although I say also in the epilogue, there are so many things that we take for granted in Indian history that probably have their origin in Ashoka, including the writing the script, right? All the scripts that we have in India are ultimately derived from the Brahmi script that Ashoka used for the first time.
Was he a visionary? Was he a reformer? What do you think?
Yes, he was a reformer. And I think we use the term, a lot of people have used the Ashokan reforms as a sort of a, you know, as a shorthand for what happened during this time. I just wrote a column for the print in India about Ashoka and Yudhishthira and Arjuna in terms of their crises of conscience. Ashoka had his crisis of conscience after the butchering of the, at the slaughter of the Kalinga war. Yudhishthira likewise had a similar crisis after the Mahabharata war. And what is interesting is that Ashoka's crisis spurred or was a catalyst for a very, very proactive philosophy, moral philosophy that he tried to inculcate. But Yudhishthira's and Arjuna's were not, right? Ultimately, people around them taught them, don't be a sissy, go on then, I mean, you be a warrior and you come back. So I think there's a lot, and his insistence on ahimsa, not killing, as an anchor of his, that outlasts him. But that had many others who helped to outlast it, the Buddhists and the Jains and everybody else, right?
In your view, what is the relationship, if any, between Ashoka and the Mahabharata and Yudhishthira, say?
Yes, so I'm not a Mahabharata specialist, but I think many people in the last 30, 40 years, from Hilda Vital to Jim Fitzgerald to Madan Biardol, they all have shown that the subtext for much of Mahabharata as we have it now is the Ashokan reforms that we talked about. And you can understand, as Johannes Bronkhorst has said, how the Brahmins won. And one of the tools that they used for their own ideology to prevail was writing, was literature. And literature was the Dharmashastra literature you have, but also the epic literature. So I think there's a subtext, there's a background for what Yudhishthira is as a literary creation, you know, of Brahmins, becomes the king who should be imitated by other kings. So in a sense, there's a political philosophy behind that, yeah.
So would it be fair to say then that in Ashoka's time historically, that one could not find that vision of ahimsa, but for within Buddhism, that he resorted to Buddhism because of that vision of ahimsa that was most clearly and staunchly defined then, and yet to be sort of assimilated within the Brahmanic fold. Would you say?
That's right. I think Ashoka was in Magadha, and that was the heartland of the new religions, not just Buddhism, but Jainism and Ajivaka and others. And a cardinal moral philosopher, the philosophy of the time was ahimsa, not killing, right? Which went completely against the warrior ethic. Warrior ethic was the kill or be killed, and both of them give you fame, the search for fame. And that is, I think, an important part of that. What Ashoka did was to take this morals precept, which was within ascetical religions, and made it mainstream, ethical principle for all human beings, not just for ascetics living outside. That was, I think, his major contribution, from which, of course, then Brahmanism takes it over. You know, ahimsa becomes central to all religions later on in India.
So Ashoka is this reformer, and clearly he's endeavoring to reform society in accordance to this vision, this novel or provocative or innovative vision. In some sense, he's a visionary, perhaps ahead of his times. But how do I frame this? I don't mean to ask a leading question, but where's this vision coming from? Because you're not saying it's necessarily a Buddhist society that he's trying to create. Actually, what you're saying is there's space for so much more. So tell us about this vision and where we think this vision might be coming from.
Yes. I say in the book that Ashoka was a king who happened to be a Buddhist, rather than a Buddhist king. That is the loaded term, Buddhist king. He was a Buddhist, and he remained a Buddhist. Where did his vision come from? Clearly, it was anchored or inspired by the Buddhist vision. And that is an important ingredient of his own philosophy. But I think he was, I mean, we have to say at some point that somebody is a visionary. Yes, a lot of things go to make a visionary successful, come to that point of me. But Ashoka was a visionary. Ashoka, for the first time in history, probably in world and human history, wanted to have a mass education campaign of all his people in ethical principles governing his country. This is a time before schools even, before even a public education, right? He was trying his hands at something that had not been there before. That, I think, was a visionary thing. And fortunately for us, at least part of his endeavor was inscribed on stone. Because of that, we have it. If he had not done that, if it was an oral communication, we would not have had this conversation today, because we would not know who Ashoka was, right? So in that sense, his vision of not just having this mass education campaign, but also his idea that writing was important part of that campaign. And this is the time, by the way, a lot of people don't know that the earliest writings of India are Ashoka's inscriptions. We have no writing before that. So yet he could not fall back on some other example, right? So he was doing it himself right now. And he had this vision that if you write it down, there'll be something there, either in some talismanic way, something where this had his own effect, or people could write. I mean, he says that people should come and listen to it. So there were people, there was the organization behind the writing who would come and actually reach from the writing. So that I think he was, in that sense, a remarkably intelligent man, and a man also was practical. In other words, he translated his ideas into a practical campaign. And something we can see just briefly is you can have a vision of creating monolithic, huge, polished pillars, and on top of it, a capital. But you have to have an enormous organization to make that happen at a time when there was no electricity or tools to make them with. So in a sense, he had that ambition of doing it and was able to practically to do it, I think.
Part of what's so compelling about the divisions of the book, the lanes in which he wrote, you know, Ashoka, the moral philosopher, versus the ruler, versus the Buddhist, part of what's compelling, you know, it might be fairly easy for one to say, well, he was influenced by Buddhism, he took this up, and this was, you know, his mission was a manifestation of that influence. But part of what I really enjoy about the flavor of the work, and this is coming perhaps more as a student of life and human beings rather than a Sanskritist or an Indologist, is that, you know, it really is a presumption that people come as if tabula rasas and they're just inscribed upon by their conditioning in that set. Anybody who's had small children quite well understand that people come with penchants, with proclivities, with personalities, you know, many of whom are on missions of various sorts. And clearly Buddhism was an influence. But what you're doing is you're leaving space for the force of the personage to carry out his vision and his mission of the world, one aspect of which was the Buddhist influence. And I find that refreshing, because it really humanizes him in a sense, rather than seeing him along this timeline of ideas as sort of a domino, and an important domino nonetheless, but it, what I feel you're doing in this book is according him with the due agency and gravitas of a visionary, of a leader, of a whole person, if that makes sense.
That's right. That's right. I think very in the second part, I tried to give a brief timeline. There was a point in time, this was around the 9th, 10th year after his royal consecration, when he writes his first inscription, where he claims publicly he's a Buddhist. Upasaka is the word he used, right? And there was a point where he could have been a Buddhist king, but something happened there. Something intervened. I tried to speculate what this intervention may be. But he found at one point saying, that is not the way I have to govern this country. It could have been a practical consideration because it was a large empire with huge diversity, religious, ethnic, linguistic. So you could not govern it as a Buddhist country. So it could have been a practical thing like that. But I think it was also a larger vision. He's thinking about my vision for as a religion for this country, as a philosopher for this country, is larger than Buddhism. And I think that larger enterprise is what I tried to showcase in parts 3 and 4, you know, the parts where I deal with his own moral philosophy and then his ecumenical enterprises, trying to get people to cooperate with the various religions to cooperate. So I think that's where his greatness lies. If he was a Buddhist philosopher or a Buddhist king, that would not have been very great. He just, you know, Constantine was a Christian king, right? There are Muslim kings, there are Buddhist kings. That would have been just a run-of-the-mill garden variety.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm glad you touched on those figures towards the end there, because I was going to say, just generally speaking, that he makes for an exceptional foil to folks who lead empires, and proselytizing is part and parcel of the project. And whether owing to his own visionary genius or owing to the very syncretic, multivocal soil of ancient India and really even modern India, it presumably was evident to him that we're not going to convert an entire nation to anything, and that will never really happen. And so, you know, let's take the more buffet approach of what are aspects that we can infuse. And really, you know, it didn't really dawn on me until I read your biography, but if one were to buy your argument, and of course I'm sure there will be quibbles in the niche, in the scholarly niche, but really he preempts and embodies what arises as classical Hinduism, in a sense, or having that integration of the ascetic ideals, space to integrate and syncretize various other traditions. And you know, it just dawned on me that he's a walking vestige of what's to come in the Indic world and even in the modern world, let's say.
Yes. As I was doing this and talking to people, somebody told me the closest another king of India comes to Ashoka was Akbar from a Muslim side. He was a Muslim, he remained a Muslim, but he had a larger vision for India, for his empire. I'm not a Mughal historian, so I don't want to venture into that area, but there are some parallels that may be instructive, because he was inquisitive about other religions, other philosophies. I think that may be the closest parallel in world history to a pre-modern king who was ecumenical in some sense, bringing in other people rather than, in other words, without sacrificing your own faith, because Ashoka remained a Buddhist throughout his life. And I think Akbar remained a Muslim throughout his life, but he could go beyond that and see what others are seeing from their own perspectives and appreciate that rather than snuff it out or suppress that. Because that is a normal religious propensity to crush others, to say there's only one truth and I have it. And Ashoka very clearly says nobody has a monopoly on truth, right? And he said nobody has a monopoly on dharma. No, dharma is too vast to be encompassed by any narrowly religious community. Yeah,
and I would say that characterization of religion perhaps is apt to a certain extent. Perhaps there are other traditions which have a genesis in breaking away and certainly proselytizing, and it's, you know, there's perhaps no shortage of that within the Indian context, but nevertheless, within the Indian context, we sort of have a, rather than a breaking away and a demarcation, we have a grafting on, we'll take that too, we'll fold that in, and there seems to be this space for these various perspectives. Having so closely examined his own words, what are some of them? What are some of the excerpts that that most resonate with you, or are more most remarkable, or made an impression on you?
Yeah, well, it's difficult to pinpoint one or two, but I think his writings addressing what he called the Pashandas, the religions of his time, are probably the most remarkable, in the sense, I wonder sometimes how a person, a king living at that time, how he could have written those things. And the other one is how he makes himself vulnerable publicly. Normally politicians try to keep their vulnerabilities hidden, right? You don't expose yourself. In his very first major rock inscription, he talks about ahimsa. Actually, he doesn't use the word ahimsa. He's used the word vihisa, vi rather than a. It's the same concept. But he says, for example, that people should not kill animals for food or for religious sacrifice. But then he reflects and says, yes, but they are being killed in my own kitchen. He admits that. And he says, right now there are three animals killed every day in his kitchen. Two peacocks and one deer or some game animal. Right? And he says, but in the future, even those will be eliminated. So he's taking the people into his confidence and say, I have been failing in this endeavor, but I'll try to do better in the future. I'm sure he had a lot of pushback from his court, saying that we can't all be vegetarians, right? You know, that thing. The interesting thing that I remark at one point is that later Sanskrit grammarians, Patanjali especially, now the century or so after, 2 centuries after Ashoka, talks about a Shaka Parthiva, vegetable king. So he tries to show how this is impossible. Vegetable cannot be king. So he tried to understand what the compound is, the Sanskrit compound. But clearly Shaka Parthiva probably refers to Ashoka, who may have been viewed as a Shaka Parthiva because most kings at the time, or all kings at the time, would not have been vegetarians, and to have a vegetarian king was something remarkable. Yeah.
And it's evident from your reflection and your writing that you really take prima facie, you take at face value that he's on a journey, a moral, philosophical, spiritual journey, and that this isn't, and please correct me if I'm wrong, to your mind, none of this is a product primarily of, performativity or politics or performativity or politics or sort of ancient, brilliant PR strategy, right?
Yes. Now, that is the problem. The something I failed to mention so far. the positive aspect of what I did, my methodology, is that it is clearly historical, not from outside. But the downside of the same thing is that I let Ashoka define himself. First thing that a historian has to do is to look at what others say about that man. So you go and look at writings of other people, what other people say, his contemporaries, right? But we don't have any of that in India at this time. So we are left with Ashoka alone. So to compensate for that, I have been always interrogating him. I've been always trying to go behind the words, trying to find the subtext. There's only so much you can do. So ultimately, you have to say, yes, that is a problem with my method. In other words, I'm letting, even after my best efforts, I'm still letting Ashoka define himself for us. And that is, we are left with that, unfortunately. Right? I don't have an Ashokan, for example, a major figure in his government who has written about what Ashoka has been doing, right? Even his children reflecting on their father. We don't have any of that. So this is the real problem for us here.
Yeah, it really is a fascinating, you know, any stance will incur a perspective and a blind spot, just you know, physically, scholarly. Any position one takes, necessarily you'll have a vantage point and you're going to necessarily have blind spots because there is no 360.
Blind spot, and this is the blind spot we have with Ashoka. Only one other thing is that Ashoka is not writing for you and me. He was writing for the people of his time, right? Now, he must have been putting the best face forward because he was writing to his own people. But at some level, he was discussing things with people of his own time. And I think that's something we have to consider here also. He was not writing a biography to be read 2,000 years later, right?
The parallel I draw, I think I make this point in a couple of places. When we're looking at Sanskrit narrative, right? The epics and the Puranas.
Yeah.
You know, for example, you know, the fascination I have with this interplay between rulers and renouncers and pravriti and nivriti, and, you know, this whole conundrum that becomes, you know, the bipedal nature of Hinduism, right? Ultimately, the idea whether or not there were forest-dwelling ascetics historically is one question. But there were certainly authors who conceived of such and imagined such and articulated such for a purpose. And that in itself evinces something about the zeitgeist, the imaginaire historically. And so whether or not, you know, Ashoka is presenting who and what he really is or the extent to which he is presenting your persona or it's a strategy or a tactic or it's PR, nevertheless, that in and of itself is a text worth studying.
Yes. Yes. No, absolutely. So there are many ways of doing that. And I hope what I have done, limited as it is, you know, limited by many things, limited by the fact that I had to keep it to 100,000 words, more or less, right? Limited by the fact that I was writing to a larger non-scholarly audience. So there are many limitations to what I did here, but could spur other scholars, including myself, to do more with what we know, not just merely philological scalpels through which we go, but also think about a larger project coming from that analysis. And we may be able to, you know, I hope that in 50 years' time, some bright young scholar would be able to write a similar book about Ashoka, would be a great improvement on what I have tried to do today.
You know, that's as brilliant as it is humble. You know, I've said this before, the best books are beginnings. They're not endings. Yes. They're not the last word. Yeah. The best books we have, they're really just the beginnings of something that will unfurl in time. And I just find it so fascinating that you've sort of narrowed your search, right? You've taken a smaller peephole in terms of the data you're looking at, but in doing so, you're looking deeper. You're looking deeper in terms of this. Let's just look at what he's saying and let us sort of connect with the personage, the psyche, the motives, you know, the human being behind behind these edicts. And, you know, I find it utterly fascinating. And in this case, I find it particularly fruitful. And who knows? Who knows where the conversation will go next and what this might inspire? Just a couple quick questions before we close for today. Was there anything else about this book that you wanted us to touch on, you hope we touch on?
I think some of the, less glamorous areas, like what I talk about Ashoka as a builder, Ashoka as a writer, maybe instructive, because often when we talk about Ashoka, we are talking about him as in some way an intellectual. But he did other things also. And that is an important aspect of his life, right? And I think something I say in the epilogue may be instructive to some people. In other words, how was Ashoka remembered and forgotten? There are certain things in Indian history, religious, philosophical, linguistic, that owe a debt to Ashoka. But nobody knows that it is a debt to Ashoka. Right? That's one thing. And then the revival of Ashoka in the early 20th century by the nationalists of India, Nehru and others, Nehru principally, that is instructive and very important. I make this statement in the beginning. I think until about the 19th century, boys who were called Ashoka were non-existent. It wasn't a name that any parent gave to the children because they didn't know about it. And now, and I show a little cartoon where Dilberts, has this bright young IT guy from India who is called Ashoka, of course, because that's a paradigmatic Indian name, which is an interesting conquest of Ashoka of the modern Indian imagination, I think. Yeah.
That is insightful and fascinating. I was going to make a joke about girls named Daenerys, but that's a whole different story for a different day. The final question I like to ask is, what now? What next? Clearly, you're an endless supply of interesting projects. What are you working on now?
Nothing very large. You know that I'm 81 years old now, so things have to get slower. But I have started writing a broad column for the print in India, and written three already. It has caused some controversy because, people don't want to always know what is historical in India, right? They always think that there is some agenda behind, and as you know, I have no agenda. But that's something I think a lot of people have said is important, because scholarship often remains within ivory towers. It doesn't go down to the ordinary people, and the print column allows me to do that, even though, there's some backlash. That's fine. It comes with the territory. That's what I'm doing right now. I do hope sometime in the future to write something again about Ashoka in a different vein, not this particular one, but again in a way that I can present Ashoka as a person to ordinary people, but in a sort of fictitious way. So it could be a work of fiction, but fiction based on history, not fiction purely of imagination. I'm thinking about that, but yeah.
Fascinating. Well, thank you very much for appearing on the podcast today.
Thank you, Rod. Thanks much. See you soon.
You're most welcome.
Yeah.
For those listening, we've been speaking with Dr. Patrick Olivelle on a brand new fascinating book, Ashoka, Portrait of a Philosopher King. Till next time, keep well, keep listening, keep reading, and keep contemplating the figure of Ashoka, the man, the myth, the legend, all or none of the above. Take care.